thank Representative De La Forest, who willingly worked with me to get his bill before the committee here this morning. I asked him late yesterday. I asked Representative Hillstrom late yesterday and Representative Erickson, so we appreciate the authors getting their testifiers and their items together in time for us to have a hearing here today. So I appreciate that very much. First thing we want to do...
Do we have a quorum?
No. Okay. We will wait on the minutes. We don't have a quorum yet. Okay. We do have a quorum. So if there's a member, I'll take a motion to approve the minutes.
So moved.
Representative De La Forest moves the minutes. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? The minutes are approved. And so with that, members, I did want to... I don't know. Is Dr. Wilson here? I don't know if he was coming. We do have a piece of information really cued off of Representative Solberg's question and the testimony on the department's bill as it relates to how the department treats behavioral effects and revenue estimates, and that's provided in your folders, members, and you can look through that. I believe it's in your folders. Yes, it's in the folders. And with that, then, if we could go to House File 174 with Representative De La Forest. Thank you, Representative. And Representative De La Forest moves House File 174.
Yes, Madam Chair. For the record, Chris De La Forest, District 49A. And Madam Chair, I understand that this will be one of a number of bills that will be heard and laid over for potential inclusion in your omnibus bill.
That's correct.
Okay. Madam Chair, thank you. I'm happy to be here today. As you know, I've got a house full of sick kids, so if I'm here today, it means I'm not home with sick kids. So I'm happy to be here. House File 174, Madam Chair, is not my idea. It's not a brand new idea. It's certainly an idea that's been around since about 1992, probably, regarding the issue of local governmental units in Minnesota paying the state sales tax. It's not a Republican or DFL idea, Madam Chair, to exempt those purchases. I think there are a number of good reasons. Anybody who served on this committee for any period of time certainly is familiar with the issue, so I won't spend a lot of time belaboring it, Madam Chair. It's one of those things I think all of us would agree it's good tax policy. It's just going to be a question of priorities. Where does this particular tax policy idea fit on our priority list as a committee? And then, of course, we got to match it up against revenues, and do we have the money to do anything, either partially or in full? So, as I said, most people on the committee are very familiar with the issue, but I would add my own editorial comment, Madam Chair, that I think it's good tax policy because, as we all know, the current policy really sets up a situation for a little bit of mischief, maybe, and certainly a lot of picking winners and losers. It's sort of ironic that you look, there are small towns out there in Minnesota that are paying for the bricks and mortar when they build a fire station, but certain private for-profit businesses are getting sales tax exemptions, and I think people can ask the question fairly, why is that? Is that just? Is that fair? More than that, even between cities and counties, winners and losers get picked. Some cities and counties end up getting sales tax exemptions when they maybe build a courthouse. Some don't. I know, for example, I learned that my first term when the city of Ham Lake built a fire station, and they didn't get a sales tax exemption. So I think that this is good tax policy to remove that the sort of mischief that goes on with power play politics. And let's offer it to everybody. Madam Chair, I would imagine there are people here who would like to testify on the bill. I think also, Madam Chair, just one more thing in the interest of disclosure, the bill as drafted right now is slightly broader than the situation as it existed prior to 1992, and if you'd like, I think Ms. Dalton would probably be in the best position to explain to the committee, if they want to hear about it, what exactly that means.
Thank you, Representative De La Forest. I think we'll do that with Ms. Dalton, and as any testifiers who want to come down, please join us. But I do think, Ms. Dalton, that would be helpful, and for those members particularly who have not been on the committee, I think it's instructive. I think Representative De La Forest's characterization of those who've served on this committee for a while bipartisanly understand that this sort of double taxation for local units of government is something that we don't want to see in tax policy. But if you could give a little context, I'd appreciate it.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the one expansion of it is, prior to 1992, there were some exemptions that the federal government got that the local governments didn't, and that was on their motor vehicle leases and on their food and lodging. And this bill essentially will treat local governments the same way as we treat the federal government for sales tax purposes.
Thank you, Ms. Fountain.
And Madam Chair, I would stand for any questions, or as I imagine there are probably some folks who want to testify on behalf of this bill.
Are there questions for the author at this time? If not, I see that the League of Minnesota Cities is looking to testify. Please join us.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Gary Carlson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. The League has supported the legislation that would exempt local government purchases from the sales tax since the law was enacted back in 1991, effective for 1992. Cities and counties have paid sales tax on purchases related to basic governmental services. There are a few exemptions in current law for some public safety purchases like bulletproof vests and so forth, but by and large, most of the purchases we make are subject to the local or to the state sales tax. Interestingly, Minnesota, I think Ms. Dalton could confirm this, but I think Minnesota is one of only seven states that currently does tax local government purchases. I believe it's something in that range. And I also believe from an earlier memo that she had drafted, we're the only state that has recently being within the last 15 years, imposed that sales tax on local purchases. All other states, the other 43 states, I believe, all exempt those purchases. There are other complications that are created by this sales tax structure. I won't get into those today. The Department of Revenue knows full well that occasionally our local governments make a purchase in another state, and that does create some confusion about what the local government, the Minnesota local government's tax liability, in fact, is. I'll leave that discussion for another day. Let me just conclude by saying that the governor saw fit in his budget to propose that certain trunk highway construction projects that the state is engaged in would be exempt from the sales tax. That will make our highway dollars go further, and this would provide a similar extension of our local monies that are used for our local roads. It would take away the 6.5% sales tax as well. Madam Chair, I'll stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson, and I see Representative Lanning has one. I do have one question, though, if I may first, and I know that you were not here. I don't think you were, Mr. Carlson, and I wasn't, and I know Representative De La Forest wasn't, but maybe you can tell us the lore of the deal that was supposedly cut as it relates to this tax that we're coming on to the local units of government. I've heard it many times in many ways, but I'd like to hear the League of Minnesota Cities version, and I think everyone's got a different version, but I think it's helpful particularly for members to think about the history as to why this tax was ever imposed.
Madam Chair, I actually joined the League in 1991 when this actually happened, so I was around, and I'll have to dust the cobwebs, but I do recall that then Governor Carlson did have to balance the budget. We had a similar state budget crisis, not quite as severe as what we faced in 2003, but he did have to come up with some savings, and one of the ways that was originally proposed was to rather severely cut local government aid. In the end, the decision was made that to spread the effect of those cuts over all local units of government. Schools are not included in the sales tax, but it was spread upon cities and counties, and at that time it was deemed to be a fairer way to try to spread the pain. You know, that said, I think it has created some misunderstandings about tax policy. As Representative De La Forest indicated, we basically are taxing fairly essential government purchases, and that was an issue that I don't know was really explored back in 1991. It was really kind of a last-minute deal to try to help balance the state budget.
Thank you. To that point, Representative Solver?
Oh, are you? He hit the nail on the head.
Representative Mullery, did you want to add to that?
Madam Chair, isn't the state do it to its account too? Mm-hmm. And is it connected in any way in time or?
Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, members, Representative Mullery, the state has been paying the sales tax on its own purchases since 1987. Back in 1987, there was again a budget crisis, and one of the proposals was to tax both the state and the local governments. And the local governments objected, and they prevailed, and they were not taxed, but the state did. Now, one of the reasons that the state imposed the tax on itself, it was a way of essentially cutting all state agency budgets without going in and cutting each individual budget.
Representative Maury.
Madam Chair, Representative De La Forest, what do you have against ourselves that you don't want to also do this for us?
Representative De La Forest.
Madam Chair and Representative Mallory, I have no objection to that, but I guess philosophically I'm still trying to wrap my brain around this idea that we tax ourselves and how exactly that works. So I guess it was easier for my brain to comprehend this particular piece of legislation, but if you want to go in on a bill to do something with the state, I'd be more than happy to sign on.
Thank you. Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Carlson, or perhaps somebody from Revenue, do we have any sense as to how much cities are paying per year?
Madam Chair, Representative Lanning, there is a fiscal note that was distributed, I believe, from the Department of Revenue, and it indicates that for cities and counties, I suppose some township purchases as well are included in that the FY08 hit to the general fund, and therefore the benefit to local government budgets would be about $125.8 million. But I think somebody from Revenue could actually explain that. I don't know what the actual breakout is for cities. I don't know if they actually have prepared the fiscal note based upon local units of government.
Representative Colburn.
That's $125.8 million for 1 year. For the biennium, so you have to add those two numbers together to our biennial budget.
Four-year biennial budget, that's correct. I was looking at it. I thought the question was from the local government perspective, how much would it save? So,
Representative Lanning, did you have further questions?
No, thank you.
Were there other testifiers?
Madam Chair, Keith Carlson, Minnesota Intercounty Association, and I'm also speaking on behalf of AMC. I don't think it's any surprise to the committee that counties also support the concept of repealing the sales tax on local governments. I won't go into any further detail. I will emphasize the governor's budget has proposed exempting the trunk highway fund from the sales tax, and this legislature a number of years ago exempted townships from the sales tax on their road materials. So we would certainly, if you want to pursue something that has a smaller price tag, appreciate you pursuing something along the lines have the governor has proposed for the state, for counties as well as for cities, as Mr. Carlson indicated. I would also indicate that the position of our organization, again, if you're looking for something of a smaller price tag, if you could at least consider exempting construction materials for courthouses and jails, that has been a secondary objective of our organization for a number of years. With that, I'll conclude my testimony and be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Wolfhager.
Chair members, I'm learning that the local government aid isn't fairly distributed through the state. Is that the case with this bill, or can you just talk to the fairness throughout the state?
Representative De La Forest.
Well, I think, Madam Chair and Representative Wolfschlager, it would be fair in the sense that, you know, if this bill, if the whole enchilada, so to speak, is enacted, it would be fair across the board because regardless of the jurisdiction that bought the brick to put in a fire station or a courthouse, they would be exempt. So I think it would be fair from that perspective. Obviously, I think it would be very difficult, and it would change from year to year and be variable regarding who's making those purchases. For example, if a county builds a courthouse, they probably won't need another one for a few decades. So I think who's spending the money would probably rotate depending upon the particular capital needs of that jurisdiction. But to get back to your basic question, the fairness of it would be if this is fully implemented, everybody gets the benefit.
Other questions? Members, I just want to comment. I think Representative De La Forest's answer there is absolutely correct, and I think members need to think about if we can find the money to do part of this, and I think Representative De La Forest is accurately bringing up, you know, the issue of the big price tag here. It's tough. You're talking a couple hundred million, $250 million a biennium. It's a lot of money. So often members carry bills that exempt certain governmental purchases for certain products that governments buy, and I think Representative Wolfschlager's question gets to that gets to that very issue. If you're a certain kind of a government that buys a lot of a certain kind of a product, you're going to get relief. If you exempt that product, if you buy other products, you're not going to get relief. And I think the trick in going forward, if to the extent we can begin to undo some of this, is the answer that Representative de la Forest gave, is what do local units of government buy pretty uniformly across the system, so that if you were going to pay for an exemption in the tax expenditure side of the tax bill, what would you buy? You know, courthouses would certainly help certain kinds of entities. You know, fire trucks would help. Actually, we exempt fire trucks, I believe. But I think that's something that members should put their minds to, as to if, to the extent we can find revenue to do some of this, what would we do? And I hope that members will talk with Representative de la Forest on that item as well, because I think bipartisanly we understand this is pretty good tax policy. It's just kind of finding the money. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative de la Forest, for bringing this bill. I carried something like this in the last biennium, and I, as a freshman, and I sure got a lot of signatures right away. It wasn't a problem from both sides of the aisle. But my question to you is, I notice on your bill here you have an effective date for purchases after June 30th, 2007, which means that this would hit in this coming biennium. And I know somebody talked to me about a bill that that phases this in or starts it further out so that it could be in the forecast. And I wonder if you consider doing that so that, I mean, obviously, as you stated up front, this is something, it's a pretty big price tag to suddenly do this, even though I think most of us do agree that there's something philosophically weird about the way we do it now. So did you think about that?
Representative de la Forest.
Madam Chair and Representative Liebling, I take no exception to saying that I'm sure Ms. Dalton had a good reason for putting June 30th in there when working on this bill. I'll admit that I have no pride of authorship in that, and you bring up a good point. I mean, this is a bill that can be sliced and diced any number of ways. I mean, we can delay the implementation date. We could limit it to certain types of purchases that this committee would agree are sort of essential for local units of government. I mean, the sky is sort of the limit about how we can reduce some of the possible revenue expenditures on this, and that's something that we'll do, I'm sure, and we'll think about. As I mentioned earlier, this is one of a number of issues that we will have to confront as a committee, and Chair Lincheski will certainly be leading this committee about what gets into the tax bill, what doesn't, and what does it look like if it does make it into the tax bill. I agree it would be nice to have this up front, but I'll be the first to admit that the price tag to fully phase this in up front is pretty steep, and it's competing with other priorities.
Thank you, and I do think, Representative Liebling, that the straight way, I think, to hear the bill is the way that Representative de la Forest has it, so that we can all see what it really costs. I mean, that's the reality check for members. I think you're right that if you did a 2009 implementation, you basically effectively don't have to deal with this biennium and this budget, and you put it off to a future biennium, and then you hope there's maybe a surplus that eats that $250, and so Representative Solberg says, you know, there's not tails on that. That got figured out. So I think, you know, you're wise to bring this up, but I think seeing what it really costs helps members try to grapple with the issue. Representative Broad.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative de la Forest, thank you for bringing this forward. I think it's one of those issues that is a little perplexing to a lot of people, you know, why we take out of one pocket and put it into another. But in regards to Mr. Carlson's comments about road construction, I hope that we also will consider some of the other infrastructure pieces, such as wastewater treatment facilities, things like that, that are really difficult for small towns, especially in large communities, too, to finance. And so I wanted to put that discussion in play as well, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Broad. Representative Wolfsager.
Chair, members, Representative de la Forest, Wabasha County is looking at putting a $30 million jail in. Is that an example of something that would receive this exemption?
Representative de la Forest.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Wolfsager, potentially, as I said, you know, if we were to fully phase this in, obviously it would fall within the scope of the bill, but depending upon how we define things to reduce the potential cost of the Treasury, it may be left out. Again, that'll be a decision that the committee will have to make.
Thank you, Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. as we slice and dice this issue, as Representative De La Forest has suggested. Ms. Dalton, does the streamlined sales tax come into play here? Would that help help us figure out how we might provide some relief, or is that irrelevant to this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lanning, the streamlined sales tax agreement would be silent on this. You could slice it and dice it pretty much as you want.
Thank you.
Well, that's rare. Thank you, Ms. Dalton. Mr. Carlson, I think, wants to address this point, and then we'll go to Representative Demmer. Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair, I didn't mean to get in front of Representative Demmer, but I just wanted to comment a little bit further on the courthouse and jail issue. Well, the concerns of the committee is correct that it depends on the timing of whether when you're going to build those new facilities and expand those facilities as to when you would receive the relief. But the one thing that's relatively unique about those facilities is in both instances they are providing facilities or services to the state in addition to the county government. In the case of the courthouse, while the operations and personnel budget of the courts is a state expenditure, the facilities for the court, the court's rooms and their ancillary offices, is still an obligation of county government. So, in effect, if you provide us relief on the courthouse, you're providing us relief on a mandated expenditure we make on behalf of the state. And the same is true of our jails. Since 2003, as most members know, we've been required to house what are called short-term offenders, individuals who previous to that date had served their time in state prisons. And now we're housing over 300 individuals a year at our expense in our facilities.
Thank you. Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, as we consider this sort of thing, you know, it's not unprecedented. We got what we tax, and then we got what rate we tax. Representative LaForce, has given any thought to maybe ratcheting down the rate that local jurisdictions pay when we start talking about...
If I may interrupt, was that a softball? Have you read bill introductions from Representative De La Forest this year? Do you know he has a bill to do just that, Representative De La Forest?
Oh, well then, batter up.
Madam Chair and Representative Demmer, that's a fabulous idea. Wonderful idea.
Really
brilliant. It's a brilliant idea. Yeah, Madam Chair, as you know, that I have introduced a bill that would repeal the temporary increase, I guess, of the sales tax back to 6%. Representative Demmer does make a good point. I mean, that's another possibility for thinking about how we may implement this legislation if it does make it into your omnibus bill.
Madam Chair.
Representative Demmer.
If I could, Madam Chair, I really didn't know, and I was not thinking about the entire one. I was thinking more just, although I do know about that one. But, you know, in terms of, we had testimony about what taxation is supposed to be, and simplicity keeps coming into my mind. And as we look at taxing some items and not taxing other items, that creates a lot of complexity, I think, out in the public in terms of this is taxable, this is not taxable. What is easier in my mind is the jurisdiction, instead of at 6.5%, maybe cities are at 5 or at 4 on whatever they are taxable. To me, it goes to simplicity, and I would encourage us to take a look at that maybe, as opposed to this is taxable, this is not taxable, and then have everybody guessing as to what it is.
Thank you, Representative Demmer. I think, members, if there are no other questions, I will then, were there other questions? I will lay this bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. I do want to ask Representative Erickson to join Representative De La Forest for her bill, and Representative Hillstrom, maybe you would all like to together. I'm not sure how you want to do that. I do want to mention one item as they're coming down in the bill we just did, and that is, Representative De La Forest mentioned something in his original testimony that we didn't talk about as we talked about your bill, and that was to reminding members that we make local units of government pay the sales tax when they construct a facility, yet we have private companies that come to the legislature who would like to be exempt from that sales tax obligation, and sometimes it's been granted in the past. There are a few proposals before the legislature this year, and I think members just need to keep that in mind as they listen to private corporations who would like to not pay the sales tax for construction, that we ask our cities and counties to do that. And so it's just something the tax committee needs to continue to weigh. Representative Mowry.
Madam Chair, are you bringing up the Thompson?
Well, Representative Mueller, one thing I'm aware of, Thompson West is one I'm aware of. I know that it's been contemplated at times for the Vikings, for the Mall of America, and I'm sure there'll be more. Job Z zones have that as well. So, I mean, these are all private entities that look for sales tax relief, yet local units of governments have to pay them. So it's just something for members to think about as they're weighing tax policy and these requests from companies. So with that, members, if we could move to House File 186, Representative Erickson, welcome to the committee. Would someone like to move Representative Erickson's bill?
Madam Chair, I would move the bill before the committee to be laid over for potential inclusion in the omnibus tax bill.
Representative DeForest moves House File 186. Thank you, Representative Erickson. Welcome.
Thank you, Chairman Lynchewski and committee. I haven't been in the tax before the tax committee very often, unless I said something even more controversial than this. But what House File 186 does is really help our manufacturing industry in our state. And I have brought with me today an owner of Glenn Metalcraft in Princeton, Joe Glenn. He happens to be a former student of mine as well, as is his wife, Shannon. But what you're going to hear from Mr. Glenn and probably from others in the audience is this need to stop holding on to private dollars and forcing a refund application and then remitting the dollars to the manufacturer who could use those dollars during that time period that the money is in the hands of the state. So what 186 does is repeal the refund requirement for capital equipment, making the exemption available when the equipment is purchased. And I think that you probably know what current law says.
And if I may, just a moment, Mr. Glenn, I think what we should do here is move all the bills and get them before us. If I understand correctly, Representative Hillstrom and Representative DeForest, I think the bills are identical. So if Representative Hillstrom is a member of the committee, so Representative Hillstrom moves House File 206 and Representative DeForest moves House File 193. So we have all the bills before us, and if we could begin with the testimony, and then we'll hear from Representative Hillstrom and DeForest on their thoughts as well. Mr. Glenn.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I am a third-generation owner of a metal spinning company, and I'm Joe Glenn, by the way. Thank you for having me this morning. We are, as I said, a third-generation metal spinning company that's been around since 1947, and we are in a transformation of sorts in investing in equipment to give us capabilities that differentiate us from our competition. It's been a costly venture, and this last piece of equipment, for example, is a $1.5 million investment for a $7.5 million company. On February 5th, I sent in a check for almost $90,000 for sales tax. The acquisition of the equipment is one aspect. The startup costs are astronomical when looking at residual equipment with cranes and lighting to training to materials, and those funds could be better served in that startup versus being tied up and waiting for that refund.
Thank you, Mr. Glenn. Are there questions of the testifier? If not, Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. I would like to call your attention to a handout that I had distributed by the page. This was a story that appeared in the Star Tribune last December, and it is the story about Glenn Metalcraft in Princeton. And you will notice in the second paragraph the detail of what it is that Glenn Metalcraft does. It is called Close Tolerance Heavy Gauge Metal Parts, a really vital part of our manufacturing industry today, because if you notice, the clients of Glenn Metalcraft, and this would be true of many like this throughout the nation, are John Deere, Case New Holland, Graco, Ingersoll Rand, and others. So the need is there. This is the tax base of rural Minnesota.
This is allowing entrepreneurs like the Glens once were, and now Joe has stepped into the fourth generation part of this, to continue this growth in rural Minnesota. But this is a company that was up for the National Chamber of Commerce Award for small businesses last year. They did not make the award as far as recipient, but they went to Washington, D.C. and were honored. And so I can attest to the fact that they are doing outstanding work in manufacturing and for our community of Princeton. And I'm very proud that we can boast this in East Central Minnesota.
Thank you, Representative Erickson. And Mr. Glenn, that's quite an honor, and I don't know who was judging that, but I'm certain they were incorrect in not selecting your company. Representative Hillstrom, did you want to give some further thoughts to this, to your bill?
Yes, actually, Madam Chair, and I do have a number of testifiers here. If I
That'd
could
be
have
great.
Them come down, that would be all right. First, we have Dave Dietrich. He's from the Chamber. Then we have Steve Wise, who's from Castro, who is also in my district. And so if we want to start with those, please come and sit here at the table.
Welcome.
Okay, Dave.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Dave Dietrich with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Thank you for this opportunity to come and speak to you today. The Minnesota Chamber has over 2,400 member businesses throughout the state. Over 80% of those businesses have less than 100 employees. Our members represent all aspects of the economy throughout the state of Minnesota, and we have over 130 local chamber affiliates throughout the state. Simply stated, the Chamber supports converting the capital equipment refund program to an upfront exemption. Supporting this initiative will help simplify the administration of the tax, and it will reduce compliance costs. The program will particularly help small businesses because they no longer have to tax the finance themselves. And as you just heard, this significantly can improve cash flow problems. It also provides sales tax relief on purchases by businesses that do not have the capability to handle the administration of the refund program right now. Simply stated, the Chamber supports this legislation because it has the dual benefit of helping business while at the same time reducing the administrative burdens on the state. I'd be happy to answer any remaining questions, and we do have a few members here to testify as well about how this particular legislation can help businesses throughout the state. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dietrich. I think if it's all right with you, Representative Hillstrom, we'd like to hear from Mr. Wise, and then members can ask questions of all your testifiers when they're done. And I know people generally have questions for the Chamber. So, Mr. Wise, welcome to the committee. If you
Thank
could
you.
State your record for your
Thank
name
you, Madam
for the
Chair,
tape.
Members of the committee. My name is Steve Wise. I'm CFO and one of the owners of Casco Machine Products. I'm also on the board of directors of the Twin West Chamber of Commerce. The plight of American manufacturers has been well publicized, and I'm sure you guys don't need a lecture on that. Since 9/11, we were in a recession at the time of 9/11, and our profits have continued to dwindle virtually every year since then. Our OEMs that Mr. Glenn, I'm sure, can nod right along with me, I can rattle off the same ones that are my customers. They are ruthless in their measures that they take against their suppliers like me. So when we talk about productivity, that seems to be something that they all get on the bandwagon. You've got to increase your productivity. Productivity means nothing to the OEMs. All that means is cost. So as we decrease our costs, our productivity is about where it belongs. Americans are among the most productive people in the world, as we all know. So what that means is that we continue to decrease our profits and squeeze our people and try and find ways to lean out our manufacturing systems. The year 2005, I spent about $600,000 on capital equipment. Last year, I spent zero. Basically, that was because of cash flow issues. I can't say any more about what happens with the cash flow in a company like mine. 6% may not seem like much to a lot of people, but when my wages stay flat and every other component of my machining industry goes up and up, it starts to hurt my people. I've got about 120 employees right now. They all feel like they're walking on eggshells every day. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Weiss. Representative Hillstrom, did you have other testifiers as well?
Yes, Madam Chair. Actually, we have Dave Owen from Lakeville. The Chamber arranged all of these people to come, so if you'd like to hear their individual stories. And also Bruce Nystead from Twin Cities North Chamber. And did Jackie make it?
Jackie,
no. Mark. And Mark Hockley also is here.
Okay. And before we begin, I'm just going to look at Representative De La Forest. Did you have additional testifiers as well? Or so this will cover it then, the folks you have. I think what we want to do is hear all the testimony first and then go to committee members' questions.
Madam Chair. Representative De La Forest and I are from the same general area. So these are testifiers for both of us.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. Hello, my name is Dave Owen. I'm the president and co-owner of DHY Corporation in Lakeville, Minnesota. We have about 65 employees, and we've been in business for about 28 years as a family-owned company. My brother and I now own the company. In fact, my brother's founded the company. And so we were working together in the basement of a house in Minneapolis years ago and have worked our way up to where we're at today. So we've kind of lived the American dream, but sadly, as you've heard from Steve, that dream is starting to die in a lot of sectors where we literally are fighting for our lives. We've got competition in China. We've got competition in India. And in other cases, we have competition even in other states in the United States where there are very aggressive programs enabling lower cost production. And the OEMs, the large original equipment manufacturers that we work for, indeed, I would echo the comment earlier, they are ruthless. And as they must be in order to retain their own market share, the price pressure is intense, and the need to continue to improve our means of production through better equipment, more modernized facilities, additional capabilities is a constant need. And when we find ourselves facing tax on capital equipment, which after all are the means of production, it's very frustrating. I will tell you that this, through 2003 and 2005, we spent over $2 million on capital equipment. And, you know, that's a lot of sales tax to be laying out up front. And we're fighting for our lives. And we had a tough year last year. And had we not received one of the refunds that came in about December time frame, it would have been a real different month. It might surprise some people on the committee to realize that companies that do $8 or $10 million a year in sales, they're not awash in cash. We're in a very cash-intensive business. Money for inventory that has to be laid out, money for capital equipment, obviously, that has to be laid out, and just the operating expenses of a precision manufacturing company are very high. So to find ourselves without the benefit of cash that is sitting in a state account somewhere, and then ultimately doing apparently no good even for the state, because it does eventually get paid back to us. It feels a little bit like being a dying patient and have blood taken from you and it just sits on a shelf somewhere and they come back and give it back to you after you're even sicker. You know, it's just sort of it seems to us from our point of view, it's somewhat discouraging. So we would really like to see it change, and I just urge all of you to consider it. When you look at the exodus of jobs from United States and also here from Minnesota, this is just part of the picture. It's part of the picture, and everything you can do to help us will be vital. So, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Owen, and I believe we have Mr. Newstead. Did I miss that? And we do have a number of committee questions, so again, we want to work through the testimony here, and then we'll go to all the committee questions. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bruce Newstead. I serve as the president of the Twin Cities North Chamber of Commerce. The Twin Cities North Chamber is a local business organization representing over 500 businesses in the northern Twin Cities suburbs. It's my pleasure to appear before you today in support of making the capital equipment tax exemption an upfront point-of-sale exemption. The Chamber, in partnership with 35 other local chambers across the state and the Minnesota State Chamber of Commerce, conducts a program annually called Grow Minnesota. Grow Minnesota is simply an effort to engage a conversation with today's business owners about the climate in which they operate. Oftentimes, the Chamber will hear about an issue that it can have an impact on, and frequently those issues impact and have a shape on our local public policy agendas. Yesterday, I was actually following up with a Fridley company on a Grow Minnesota visit. And the owner mentioned that he was recently audited by the Department of Revenue and told that he was failed to pay an upfront tax on a $160,000 capital equipment purchase. The department issued its findings and directed the owner, of course, to immediately pay the tax that should have been paid at the point of sale, as well as $2,800 in interest, then apply for his refund. This business owner, like many others, was aware that his purchase in Minnesota would be exempt from the tax. However, unlike many other exemptions, he was not aware that the law required him to then file for a refund. I believe the current mechanism for administering the tax is confusing to businesses, but especially our small business segment in Minnesota. It's my contention today that making the capital equipment tax exemption an upfront exemption will reduce compliance costs for businesses, as well as hold benefit to the state and a cost perspective. And I appreciate your consideration of these changes to the state tax laws. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today.
Thank you, Mr. Newsted. And Representative Hillstrom, do we have Mr. Hockley?
Yes, that's
right. Mr. Hockley, if you'd join us. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
I think that's a prop. That is my guess.
Half a prop.
Thank you, Mr. Hockley. Welcome.
My name's Mark Hockley. I'm with AFIC Finishing and Michael Plating here in Minneapolis. We represent about 200 employees. This is half of our paperwork for 2005 for sales rebate. I second everything that these gentlemen have said and the bills, everything that's been presented. But there's another side in just the amount of effort that it takes for all of our businesses to put this together on an annual basis. Like I said, this is half of our paperwork. It takes between 200 and 240 hours of man time to do this. So you're looking at 6 weeks of time for somebody just to put this together. That's significant. Besides the dollar value, it also hits us with our production. So there are a lot of companies that hire folks to do this for them. Typically, it's a 25% fee. Up to 2 years ago, we did that. That was about a $5,000 bill. We've done it ourselves the last 2 years. It would have been $11,000 last year. And for the first half of 2006, it would have been $24,000. That's pricing. That's money that goes away that we don't get back. And that's have somebody else prepare this for us. So it's significant. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hockley. That's a compelling testimony. And we'll go to questions now, members. I do think one piece of information that might be helpful for the committee, particularly for members who have not been aware of this quirk or the shift or gimmick that we've got in the Minnesota tax system. I know often legislators feel that all the shifts and gimmicks have been bought back, but that's not the case. This is one right here. And if Ms. Dalton maybe could just give some context to when was capital exempt originally? What was the goal of exempting capital? I think that's obvious to most members, but I think it's worth hearing. And then where did we fall in the calendar where it had to be another, I'm sure, deficit that we decided we would ask these manufacturers to pay their sales tax up front and then we would later turn around and reimburse them for that? Ms. Dalton.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, actually this is really a holdover from something that was actually pretty legitimate. Back in 1984, the state reduced the sales tax on special tooling and new and expansion manufacturing capital equipment from the rate of 6% to 4%. And because you had to be able to differentiate between new and expansion versus replacement capital equipment, it was done as a refund, as a refund program. The tax was paid and then businesses applied for a refund of the 2%. In 1987, the rate on new and expansion capital equipment was actually reduced to zero. So then there was a 6% rate on replacement and a zero rate on new and expansion. In 1994, the state began phasing out the tax on replacement capital equipment. It went from 6.5% to 2%. And in 1996, the tax on all capital equipment, regardless of whether it was new or replacement, was phased out. So really, the refund mechanism is a holdover from the fact that we used to tax capital equipment differently depending on whether it was new or whether it was replacement. And at the time that it was totally phased out, there was money to do the total phase out, but there wasn't money to handle the one-time costs of the going from a refund mechanism to an up
upfront exemption, and so they decided it was better to just phase it out and keep the refund. And so we've had this refund mechanism in since 1996 without really a major reason for having it.
And if I may, if you could just discuss the policy reason, you know, that the former tax committees would have decided to not tax capital. I mean, I'm assuming that the folks who were here then thought that would encourage Minnesota manufacturers to do more business in Minnesota. But also, along that line, you know, when we talk about manufacturers paying this tax and why they should or shouldn't, can you tell us what states are doing something similar?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I did not bring my state-by-state comparison, unfortunately. But the main reason for not taxing capital equipment is the reason for not taxing business inputs generally, is that you end up with tax pyramiding. That, you know, sales tax in theory is a tax on final consumption, but when you tax business inputs, that gets built into their costs, and so essentially the effective sales tax rate on some goods are much higher than the 6.5%.
Thank you. Representative Fulber.
Madam Chair, maybe this is to somebody in the Department of Revenue. If we have a input and then an outgo, they balance each other. Can you tell me why there's a $74 million and $39 million in the displanium? Is that the rules that do not apply?
Is there someone from the department here? I think it's buying the shift. I think it's a timing issue. But Ms. Templin, did you want to Mr. Manson? Not
but
sure.
It's an in and out. So.
Madam Chair, Representative Solberg, the revenue estimate shows for fiscal 08 a $74.6 million revenue loss, and that loss declined through fiscal year 2011. The first year is higher in revenue loss because you're getting the combined effect of both the refunds being paid out and increased participation in the upfront exemption by businesses.
But then tell me, I mean, Madam Chair, why it doesn't go down to zero in 2011?
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, Representative Silver, the bill proposes to repeal the refund requirement, and it is still allowing the capital equipment exemption. So there's still the cost of the exemption, and the repealing of the refund program is phasing out. I believe, Madam Chair, Representative Silver, that these companies have up to 3.5 years to apply for the refund.
Mr. Manson, if you want to join us. Representative Earhart, is that to that point or something else?
I think it's very much to the point, Madam Chair.
Representative Earhart.
Representative Hillstrom, what that means is that you've had it now explained why there's going to be a shortfall in the general fund is that there'd be less money for early childhood, K-12, higher ed, health care, and other forms of payments from the general fund that you might use that for. I just wanted to make that point. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Earhart. Mr. Manson, did you want to further add to Representative Solberg's question?
Madam Chair and committee members, Jack Manson with the Minnesota Department of Revenue. One explanation for the tails is that there will be an increased participation. Some businesses don't apply for the refund just because they don't have maybe the staff and they don't follow it and keep track of it. So that's one reason. I believe our estimate on that is like $4 to $5 million a year. But I believe the other component is that actually these the prices of these equipment, the sale of this equipment is rising, so there's always a little increased growth there that's shifting from year to year. So I think it's a combination of the increased price along with this increased participation level as well.
But Madam Chair, if you have an increased price, I mean, I can understand the cash flow problem that businesses have, and I can understand that the state probably is driving some interest from that as well. I mean, I'm very sympathetic to the businesses. I just am having a hard time understanding if I got money coming back, if I got
$10 coming back. I want to apply for it no matter how long it takes me to get it. I mean, I pay for someone to do my income tax to make sure I get all the money deductions I am legally entitled to. I mean, that's part of my cost of doing business as well. And I'm just surprised that there wouldn't be every business getting their money back on this, no matter what. And if it's a drop off of $4 million, that's a considerable amount of money. I guess I'm trying to understand revenue estimates as opposed to fiscal notes, and have got ways to go on that. And Representative Harris, as long as I got the floor, you should have been here and asked Representative Dela Forest the same question. On his
I
first
will.
Bill. Okay.
and members, I think it is worth thinking about this a little bit. For those who have been on the committee for a while, when Governor Ventura wanted to expand the sales tax base and reduce the rate, a lot of what was, I think, left out, and part of the reason he didn't succeed is because some of the business pyramiding issues on taxing the inputs was not uniformly addressed, and so I think there were also political ramifications. There were two political parties who I don't know that they were too interested in helping him succeed, but I think that's part of the issue here. I mean, if we're going to get to the point where we stop taxing business inputs, you know, I don't know that revenue would want to be counting them as a cost to the state. I mean, at some point, if it's good policy to not do business pyramiding, I don't know why we'd have that as a revenue estimate that we should count as a loss to the state, but maybe that's just me, so I'm trying to understand that too. Representative Simpson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is probably for revenue again. being a business person, I have to pay sales tax on a monthly basis, and I have 30 days to pay it. And I guess one of my questions for revenue is, what's the time frame in the turnaround on these reports? Once these reports are in, what's the turnaround, and what is the goal of the department as far as the turnaround time? Do we have a 30-day turnaround, or do we have an open market turnaround?
Ms. Manson.
Madam Chair and Representative Simpson, my understanding is we try and process these as quickly as we can, and I believe the majority of them are done in 30 days. But the larger ones that actually can result in an audit of the purchase, actually going to the taxpayer's place of business, could take up to 6 months, I believe, is my understanding. So most of them are done readily in like 30 days, but I know some of the larger ones do hang out there for quite some time.
Thank you. Representative Simpson.
And to that point, what triggers an audit if these people are sending in their report and they're sending in, as that gentleman had a whole stack in front of him, a whole file of paperwork that's coming forward, what would trigger a audit due to the fact that he's already sent in his correct paperwork? Wouldn't we work off of that paperwork?
Mr. Manson.
Madam Chair and Representative Simpson, we do look at the larger ones, the larger claims, because it's more dollars involved. We look at their paperwork, but I know there's also some questions on how the equipment's being used, you know, as a part of the production process, you know, what it is, and I know we follow up on just kind of looking more closely at some of the larger claims.
Thank you. Representative Broad.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And that's just going back to Representative Solberg's point, you know, about the $10, you know, you would expect that these folks come and get those $10 that they're owed. But the problem is, from a business standpoint, is if it costs you $20 to get that $10 back, your money out. And I think that book that that gentleman brought forward shows the cost that it actually could take in terms of staff time, consulting time, to get those dollars out. So it's just a simple cost-benefit analysis whether you go after that or not. So I guess I can understand the diminishing part of the note. But, Madam Chair, I'm wondering if I could ask a question to Mr. Owen.
Yes. Mr. Owen, if you would join us again. Representative Broad.
Mr. Owen, thank you very much for being here. I'm wondering, as a business owner, what is your perspective on what makes it difficult for you to be competitive in the worldwide marketplace that we have now? I mean, if you could key into a couple things in regards to competitiveness.
But
when you talked about
4 hours, is that?
Yeah, that's right. But when you talk about the plight of the manufacturer and things like that, I'm just wondering if you can point to just a couple of things in regards to that.
Well, fundamentally, in terms of international competition, the biggest driver, of course, is labor.
okay, in the last 10, 20 years, something like 3 billion people have come into the global labor pool through China and India in terms of open trade. So it seems from our perspective to be too much too fast, and I know this is maybe beyond the scope of this body, but that's a big overarching problem. Where you've got people who are intelligent people and hardworking people in these countries, and they're working, they're poor on a scale that's unimaginable to us, and they're just able to work for 10 times, 100 times less money. So the completely open trade policies that have been pursued in the last 10 or 20 years have, I think, hurt a lot, even though they may be a good idea in the long run if they were taken at a more even pace. So that's one factor. Another factor has been that the United States culturally, at least with respect to our business, in terms of precision machining and the skill levels required, our culture seems to have lost its appreciation for that. If you look at countries where they have lost wars in the last 100 years, like Germany, they remember why they lost. They remember that they didn't have people to make ball bearings, or they literally couldn't make the weapons that they needed to prosecute. Even though what they had going in that case was bad, and we're glad they lost, but that's why, right? They lost the skill, and we're rapidly losing that skill as we see business going offshore. It's not just an economic impact on the bottom line of this year, but it's a long-term impact when the know-how is migrating away from our society and away from our population. And you only need a few generations to break that chain, that tribal knowledge, the apprentice-mentor type of relationships that go on, particularly in industry and in high-skilled jobs. Once that chain is broken, you don't easily get it back, if ever. And when we look at many developing or undeveloped nations and ask why are they that way, of course there's many reasons, but that, I'm sure, is one of them. If you look around this room, every single thing that we see in this room, aside from the flesh on our own bodies, was in the hands of a skilled technician somewhere, a skilled machinist perhaps, a mold maker. The equipment that brought all of this stuff here, the equipment that keeps these lights running, everything that we see around us was in the hands of a person like that. And yet how many of us are aware of that? Or it's so amazing to me to have bankers and lawyers and educated people through my plant, and their eyes are all amazed. They just never thought of this before. How do you make things like this out of metal? How do you make things within plus or minus a 10,000th of an inch? They just are unaware. So that unawareness leads to things like lack of funding for vo-tech schools, a lack of cultural prestige for so-called blue-collar jobs, when in fact those kinds of skills and jobs and businesses are the engine. They're really at the core of the economy, much like agriculture is, or something where you're creating new wealth. What is it in our economy that's generating new wealth? It's those kinds of skills, abilities, and companies. So as we lose that culturally, we're finding it very difficult to find the skilled workers that we need to sustain competitiveness. Whereas you go to a place like China, and of course they have a much larger population, but there is an enormous effort there, even at the primary school level, to get children involved in engineering careers and in machining and manufacturing, things that you must know about and must be highly skilled in to remain competitive globally. Anywhere you go, go look at an X-ray machine and ask yourself, where did this come from? Look at your eyeglasses or your contact lenses and think about, where in the world, how did somebody make this? And the equipment that it was made with and the skill that it required is staggering, just staggering, and we're losing it. And again, I don't mean to be long-winded, but there's lots of just trying to pick some key things. Does that answer your question? Or?
Yes, Madam Chair. I just, when we have a business owner in the committee, I just think it's really good to hear from you what it is regarding competitiveness. And I imagine everybody has a different opinion.
Yeah.
We talk a lot about tax. We talk a lot about education. We talk a lot about these issues. But often we don't talk necessarily about how they get hit the ground.
Right.
So I appreciate that.
If I could make one further comment about the sales tax and its direct impact. When that cash is gone, again, it may be a surprise to see an $8 or $2 million a year company flying so close to the ground sometimes, in terms of its cash reserves or its cash flow. But it does happen. And it causes us to make strategic decisions that are really the wrong decisions. because of $70,000 that's not there, or $30,000 that's not there, or we're not sure when it's going to be there. We've seen our refunds take a lot longer than the numbers I just heard them. I don't think we've ever seen one in a month. So it has this leveraging effect, you know, or sort of a, it's sort of a BB going through a glass where it's bigger on the back end than it was on the front. And it's $50,000 or $40,000 on one day. But the decisions that are made because of the lack of that cash being in circulation have this big impact on jobs, big impact on skills, training, the kinds of projects and customers that we go after, that we feel confident to go after because the cash is there. You know, we've brought $120 million into this state in the last 28 years from outside the state, in many cases outside the country via exports. But when you don't have the confidence to go after things because the cash isn't there, it has a snowball effect.
Thank you, Mr. Owen. Mr. Glenn, did you want to add to that? And
yes,
remember, we have lots of questions, so Mr. Glenn.
Madam Chair, in speaking to the competitiveness issues in the manufacturing where we have faced steel prices more than doubling in the last 3 years, stainless steel prices up 140%, aluminum prices up almost double, coupled with health premiums going up on an average of 10 to 12% a year. The costs of the inputs are just expanding exponentially, and to stay ahead of that curve is next to impossible. Our G&A every year is shrinking. We have to be able to compete and survive. The inputs are more difficult when working with the ruthless large OEMs such as Deere and Case. We have a program set up with them that we invoice for surcharges at the end of the month. They can take up to 90 days to pay for surcharges, which can be, you know, $100,000 sitting on the books at any given time. So the money isn't free-flowing, as you've already heard. And speaking to the length of time that it often takes to receive the refund, I believe the way that the law is set up now, after 90 days, the state does actually pay interest on the money. I've not yet seen a refund inside of 90 days. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Glenn. Representative Mowry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, I'd like to thank the next-to-last testifier for the eloquent explanation of the need for training scientists and engineers, and especially the technical schools. But what I wanted to do was go back to Pat Galton's statement when you said that because, you know, the tax on businesses gets added into the final cost, you said, therefore, the legislature decided not to tax this, and I'm wondering why we decided to pick this one to drop when we have all kinds of business tax. I mean, you kind of begged questions. You just made this assumption when there was all kinds of things sitting out there exactly almost the same.
Ms. Dalton, why did the legislature decide to get at this part of business pyramiding as opposed to all the other parts of business pyramiding and taxing inputs?
Madam Chair, Representative Mullery, you're correct. 40% of the sales tax revenues come from businesses. Businesses are, you know, paying a big chunk of it. Capital equipment, and now I have to admit, I was not here in 1984. I may defer some of this question to Joel, but I believe a lot of it had to do with an incentive to, because it started out as new and expansion equipment, it was really a business incentive to get people to locate here, to expand businesses here.
Mr. Michael, did you want to add to the lore and the history for all of us?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think Pat's explanation is fairly accurate. I think that the legislature, you know, it's, you can't ever tell exactly why the legislature does anything. but I think it's partially in response to the same kind of testimony that you've just heard, which is to say manufacturing generally is consistently an export-type business in Minnesota. So many of the items that these businesses make don't get sold in Minnesota, but they get sold across the nation. And so in making choices about a limited budget for exempting business input. I think the thought was where we get the best return on our investment is to exempt things where our businesses are competing nationally. So it would make less sense, for example, to start exempting stoves for restaurants or for cash registers for retailers, because their markets are all local, are largely local, and so there's not as much sort of hoped return for the investment. And so this was sort of like a high priority on that scheme of things.
Thank you, Representative Mallory. Representative Wolfslager.
Chair members, I too would like to thank Mr. Owen for your comments. I have a district, Mr. Owen, that has a 100-year-old shoe factory. They're making boots. And it's a trade. And in Lake City, we used to have a pearl button factory. And guess what? Nobody in Lake City knows how to make pearl buttons anymore. So you're right on. You know, we're also dealing with a culture, and I work for a large company, too, that's got manufacturing in its name. We're dealing with America's culture that wants things fast, they want it cheap, and they want a lot of variety. And I can't change that. But one thing I would like to know, and maybe it's from a representative here or from the revenue commissioner, have we made any effort to look at the savings? You know, by not transferring paper back and forth, by not, transacting refunds here and there, have we done any type of work to figure out what that savings is to offset what these dollars are on the fund impact?
Did we want to hear from Mr. Manson or?
Yeah.
I think they're looking on that. They're thinking on that, Representative Wolfslager. I don't know if they need a minute. Here comes Mr. Manson, if you want to answer.
Well, I guess to further my point, what I'm trying to do here is I think this is a good idea. I would like to support this. But when you look at the dollars lost, somewhere you have to compensate back that, okay, there are some dollars lost by doing this, but we're also saving money through a more efficient government system. So,
Mr. Manson.
Madam Chair and Representative Wolfslager. I don't have any information on what the savings would be. I'm guessing it's one or two positions that deal with these. I would have to double check. But we support an upfront exemption. We would rather deploy those resources maybe in audit where we're getting a much better rate of return on those positions. So it's something I'll get back to the committee on how much we have invested in that, but we do support an upfront exemption and get away with all that processing of paper for both us and the taxpayers. So,
Representative Wolfslager.
Just on that point, Commissioner, it's not just the one or two positions from the Department of Revenue, it would be the business people as well.
Did you have a response, Mr. Manson? Or?
Well, just Madam Chair and Representative, we won't have the capability to determine the amount of money that is spent by the business community on, processing that paper. We'll just be able to get back to you on what the department's costs are. And I know it's a larger picture than that, but...
Thank you, Mr. Manson. Representative Paulson, is your question to this point, or...?
It was kind of on that same point, but Madam Chair, I think it's just important point. We've had a real good discussion on this today, but it's interesting, and I know the department's talked about having that 30-day window where they turn things around, but the folks who have testified today say they haven't had anything. They haven't seen anything within the 90 days, and it seems so that we're paying interest on purchases for the refund when, clearly there must be some administrative cost savings here as well, as recognizing this is good tax policy, and the Hillstrom bill, the Forrest and Erickson bills definitely seem a good direction to go.
Thank you, Representative Paulson, and I thought that too. If we're getting to the point where we're not making 90 and we're hitting interest on most of them, then that's maybe a compliance discussion and a staffing discussion in revenue. So I think that point is well taken, Representative Paulson. Mr. Glenn, did you want to speak
Madam
to that?
Chair, if I may clarify.
Yes.
It's after 90 days that the tax is paid, and it's from 90 days forward. So there is interest earned by the state in that first 90 days.
Yes. Did members understand all that? Representative De La Forest, to that point?
To that point, Madam Chair, as I understand in discussions with staff, I'm moving over here so I can have a microphone, that in 2005, the Department of Revenue, as I understand it, paid about $6 million in interest for missing that 90-day window. So there's $6 million the state could have held on to.
Thank you, Representative De La Forest. I think we'll have further discussions about that with the Department of Revenue, but we want to get to all members' questions for authors and testifiers. Representative Dabney.
I don't know. Madam Chair, Mr. Manson, I just seem to be going further and further down the rabbit hole on this fiscal note and costing. I think I'm trying to ask in a different way the same questions Representative Solberg asked, is if you got $20 going into my left pocket and I pull out $20 out of my right pocket, I'm not clear how that adds up to $74 million. And I've heard that about $4 or $5 million a year in refunds don't get applied for. So it seems like the actual cost to the state is not $74 million, but is $4 or $5 million. And I'm wondering, maybe, Mr. Manson, the two most specific questions is, how much does the state collect annually on sales tax on this equipment? And how much do we pay out annually in refunds of sales tax paid on this equipment?
Mr. Manson, and before you answer that, I wonder if, and I don't see it sitting here on the table, but I'm wondering if the latter part of your question, we may be able to get in the tax expenditure book fairly quickly,
okay,
as what is the cost yearly for this exemption. But Mr. Manson, did you?
Madam Chair and Representative Dabney, the cost here is just a shift. It's just you pay the refund in a year later, as opposed to whether it's up front. The cost is the same. You give the money back because there's no tax rate on it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just a shift. You're shifting from one year, one biennium, forward. So that's mainly what you're seeing here is that shift component. Then the tails, as I tried to explain, is we think there's $4 to $5 million that people aren't even claiming that they're due, which is another problem with this being a refund rather up front. If they're entitled to the refund, they should get it, whether they apply or not. So that's one component. And then it's just the case where the claims grow because of the cost of the equipment grow. And so you have to look at each year, and you're just shifting from year to year. So as the claims would grow, then that little tail would shift forward. So it's all a matter of shifting, other than that one little $4 to $5 million component, that's participation increase. And there is... I know we did kind of a chart that kind of shows this that might be helpful for the committee. We did it a couple years ago on this issue. Maybe if you look at the three parts, you can kind of see how we kind of get to both the shift and participation level. That might be helpful. And I can get that to you, Madam Chair, and distribute that.
I do think that would be helpful, Mr. Manson. Representative Dabney?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Manson. I'll continue to noodle.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, that answer kind of raised a real quick question for me that was aside from the one I wanted to ask, which is just, is the interest that the state pays out now for not meeting the deadlines, is that figured into this revenue estimate so that, because that would be a savings to us, I assume. Is that in there?
Mr. Manson.
Madam Chair and Representative Liebling, I'm quite positive that interest calculation is not part of this. This is just based on the amount of claims for refund we see and then shifting those. We generally don't take into consideration interest or penalties, as we talked about in another hearings.
Okay, Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Liebling.
Thank you.
Another question?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. That wasn't actually my original real question, but actually from what you just said, so that it should be costing us less than it actually says here. But my real question, first of all, I just want to say that the testimony was very compelling, and I just wanted to ask the gentleman that showed us the exhibit, all the paperwork, quite apart from all the issues about, should we be doing this at all, I just wondered what is causing there to be so much paperwork, and maybe Mr. Manson could tell me whether there's any effort or possibility of simplifying that if we don't change this policy altogether.
The creation of the paperwork and the requirements of the paperwork are dictated by the state, not ours. So this is what we're asked for.
Thank you, Mr. Mockley. And Mr. Manson, did you want to answer further?
Actually, Madam Chair, I was hoping to hear more from the testifier. It's been a long time since I've seen.
He had the right answer, though.
For him, so. But, I mean, if there's something we can simplify, we're obviously open to doing that. I'm not that familiar with how complicated the form is or what detail we require, but I'm sure we're open to less paper and an easier way of doing all kinds of things, especially like this. So.
Madam
Mr.
Chair,
Manson, Representative Simpson,
to that point, I'm under the understanding also that we can only apply twice a year for this refund. Is that correct? Is that a reason that we couldn't look at doing this on a monthly basis,
Mr. Manson,
or at least quarterly?
Madam Chair, Representative Simpson, the requirement is you can't apply more than twice a year, and I think it's just so we don't get a lot of small ones that would even be more paper worth processing, and I think it's trying to encourage taxpayers to kind of lump them together so we're not processing 10 times the amount of refunds we are now. Could we look at doing more? If that makes sense, we would be open to that.
Thank you, Mr. Manson, and thank you for the question, Representative Simpson. We have Representative Mullery and then Atkins. Mullery.
Oh, well, thank you, Madam Chair. It's been pointed out by a couple members that we end up having to pay some interest back to them, but what it's not calculated into this is that what we make on interest on that money, and that if we're talking about what we're paying out, I think we should be talking about what we're getting to on it.
Yes, Representative Mullery. Mr. Manson, are you calculating in the revenue estimate the money the state makes while it earns interest on the interest of the manufacturer?
Madam Chair, I'm sure that's not included in this estimate. I know there's, I don't know if I should raise this or not, but...
Mr. Manson, did you look to see if Representative Solberg was in the room before you decided?
Yes. It is a requirement that the department actually hold up to $50 million of capital equipment refunds for the 90-day period. So, and it's not something that we really work on. It just seems that naturally that happens because, like I said, we try and process smaller ones quickly, but then the larger ones that need more audit and consideration, actually there is a $50 million that kind of just moves beyond the 90 days. So it was a budget idea that was passed in 2003, I think. So that's another component of this whole discussion.
Very interesting component. Thank you for bringing that up. Representative Atkins and Colson Earhart. Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The word arbitrage comes to mind when I see words like that. But my comment with respect to the making the refund process more manageable, more efficient, is it still is, like my dad always says, earrings on a pig. At the end of the day, all it does is dress up what, you know, if I could wave a magic wand and do away with this, I'd do it in a heartbeat. My question for Mr. Manson is a practical one. If you couldn't wave a magic wand and make it go away in a heartbeat, is there a phase out that would apply? Is there? I know you guys have been wrestling with this for a long time. Is there other ideas on how to best go about it in a manageable way that doesn't cause too big of a headache for the budget that we're about to put together?
Mr. Manson.
Madam Chair and Representative, there's two components in the governor's tax bill. One is just targeted at the woods industry, forest industry, and then the other component of that is a small business exemption. So businesses with less than 20 employees and less than $1 million in revenues could get an upfront exemption. One other option that we considered in the department, and it would take more analysis, but if there was an amount of dollars that you would be willing to invest in this, we would look at an option where it would just be exempt based on the amount of the purchase, and then you could just gradually phase it in. So, you know, anything under whatever $10,000 or whatever the number is, I don't know how large it is, right at the point of sale, it would be simple for both the taxpayer and the retailer to know, well, that's under $10,000 and that's exempt. So, with an exemption certificate, but that's one way we thought would might work if you could determine how much you wanted to invest, you know, on an ongoing basis. We could try and back into what, based on the refunds we receive now, how we can do that. So, that's one option we're kind of interested in. If, you know, it's,
Thank you, Mr. Hanson, Representative.
Chair, thank you very much. I think that's a great idea, and then you just gradually bump up the exemption to the extent that you can afford it year in and year out until it's all gone. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Atkins, for that. I sense maybe a bill might come out of that from some member of this committee. Representative Cole.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to dovetail off of what Representative Atkins was just discussing, Madam Chair, I think, you know, first of all, the testimony from the various witnesses was certainly compelling. To me, this makes absolutely no sense. I mean, we're taking it away with the right hand, then turning around, giving it back with the left hand, and in some cases, giving back more than we would have had to outlay if we had done it in a timely manner. I've also heard around this committee or on the committee from both sides of the aisle basically echo that. I think everybody recognizes that this doesn't make much sense and it's not very good policy. So, Madam Chair, I guess my comment to you, and it Representative Earhart hit on it a little bit earlier when he was asking somewhat facetiously, well, what are you going to do about health care, Representative Hillstrom, or education? Madam Chair, I guess my point to you or my request of you is let's not lose sight of the fact that you're going to have a budget target as well. There's going to be a tax target. Madam Chair, I guess I'm going to encourage you and members on the other side of the aisle to work with your leadership to try to make sure there's some money in the tax committee budget so that we can do some of these things that make sense. I agree that there's going to be a need for more investment in certain areas of the budget, you know, education, healthcare, whatever we want to talk about. But I think there's a real policy need, Madam Chair, to take a look at some of these tax fairness issues. And, you know, we've got jobs here, as the witnesses talked about, that are at risk. If we've got a $10 million business that is having to make what the witness said was probably not the best decision because of a cash flow issue, and he's employing 100 or 200 people, Madam Chair, that's something that ought to cause us all concern. And if we don't make some of these changes, we're going to end up with more people on state health care programs. We're going to have more outlays from other parts of the budget. So, Madam Chair, I encourage you to work with your leadership and make sure there's some money in the tax target so that we can do some of these things and address some of these tax fairness issues. I really urge you to do that, and I wish you success as you try.
Thank you for that, Representative Coles. And I do think that's the tough nugget for this committee. And Representative Coles, you're absolutely right. Fighting for the best target this committee can get. We're that unique committee, of course, members, that gets to raise the revenue for our target. Unlike all the other committees who just get a target, we actually have to find the money for this target, and we have to find the money for every other committee's target. So we are the double duty committee of the Minnesota Legislature, and I think we all know that, and that's why we wanted to be here, is be a part of that debate as to what kind of revenue should be raised in the Minnesota tax system and to purchase what. And these, I think Representative Coles has absolutely hit on the good policy brought forward by Representative Hillstrom and Erickson and De La Forest. This is a very real issue for Minnesota manufacturers, and I thought it was worth committee time to really think this piece through. So it's sort of stay tuned, I guess, and I think we'll all be thinking about this diligently. We're almost ready to adjourn, but I do want to get to Representative Earhart's last question. Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hillstrom, De La Forest, and Erickson, I didn't want you to think that I don't support your bill. What I wanted to do, Representative Hillstrom, make sure you know that this is probably a very good vote for the Taxpayers League, but not such a good one for the Institute for Tax Justice.
Thank you for that, Representative Earhart. Are there other questions? If not, members, I'm going to lay over House File 186, 193, and 206 for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax. So thank you, authors. We appreciate it very much.